Well, let's take our Bibles and return again to the book of Esther in the Old Testament, page 398, I believe it is today, Esther chapter 5. Esther chapter 5 has two very distinct scenes. Esther, the queen of Persia, headlines the first eight verses, and Haman, the second highest official in Persia, is featured in the last six verses. And these two, Esther and Haman, really illustrate two drastically different ways of life. And you can call them God's way and man's way. Esther's way was the brave faith that we see that she will act upon, her faith in God. And, well, Haman's way was arrogant anger. Anger comes easy. Faith is hard. Anger is just reacting to things naturally. And Haman illustrates this basic principle we'll look at right up front. The two ways to live are basically that which seems right to us and that which is right before God. Proverbs 14:12, there is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. That's where Haman is headed. If you know the story, and I know most of you have probably read the whole book of Esther at some point, you know where it's going. It's a popular view to just do what is right. It is unique when someone acts in Esther's way of brave faith. So let's do a fast rewind. The beautiful Jewish orphan girl Esther is chosen as the next queen of Persia. Her older cousin Mordecai, who raised her as a younger cousin after her parents died, Mordecai has angered this Haman, the second highest official in the land, because he refused to kneel when Haman walked by. And Haman, in his utter spiteful hate, decided not only would he kill Mordecai, but he found out Mordecai was Jewish. He said, I'm going to kill all the Jews in all of Persia. And so he manipulated a way through King Xerxes in which he would get this decree accomplished in which on a given date, it was some 11 months in the future, anyone could kill any Jew throughout the kingdom and plunder and take their stuff. And so that's the cloud under which the Jewish people living in exile, if you will, in Persia are living. So Mordecai gets a message to his cousin Esther, now the queen, and Mordecai says, you need to tell the king you are Jewish, because they didn't know that. He had told Esther to keep it a secret, and she had, and you got to tell him now that you are Jewish and plead for your people. Only one problem. Here's the hard part. There was a law in the land that if anybody dared to walk into the presence of the king in the inner court uninvited, they were to be immediately executed, unless the king held out the golden scepter. And that's where we left the story last week. I hope you're able to sleep. Verses 1 and 2 now. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. Third day has reference to the fact that she had called for a three-day fast at the end of chapter 4. After 3 days of fasting and praying, she put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. In other words, just where she shouldn't be. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall facing the entrance. When he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her and held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. So he held out the scepter. It turned out good, right? This is huge, but it's really just where the drama begins. But she acts in faith. But she's also not too dumb. She dressed up. She dressed up, and we already know she had incredible natural beauty, and so she's looking gorgeous. And when he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he's thinking, you know, I'm impressed with her. Not only is she beautiful, but she has some nerve walking in when it's against the law. And I think he's somewhat impressed that she's more than just a pretty face. And so he is pleased with her and holds out the gold scepter that was in his hand. There actually is a carving from that time, just the generation before Xerxes. It's a carving of his dad, Darius the Great, holding a scepter. So we assume the throne looks something like that. I don't know, being a king looked kind of uncomfortable to me. But that's the idea, the gold scepter. And the scepter was like a symbol of authority. It was a symbol of justice held by kings or judges. So this act of holding out the scepter obviously saved her life. But to understand her fear, I mean, it seems so simple reading these two verses, you got to go back and let's just read what Esther told her cousin Mordecai when Mordecai said, you got to go and plead for our lives. Verse 11 of chapter 4, all the kings, she sends this message, all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the gold scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king, so I've not even seen the king for 30 days. And so, cousin, do you understand what you're asking me to do? If I go walking in there against the law and he's in a bad mood for whatever reason, or he wasn't that thrilled with me last time we were together, or all he has to do is scowl. And the guards who are standing there are just going to probably just cover my face with a black cloth and take me off to the gallows. And so her walk into that doorway was a critical, dreadful, fearful, difficult moment. We all tend to imagine a worst-case scenario if we're afraid of something, even if it's not realistic. Well, this actually was realistic. This would happen. And so in her fear, but yet feeling the tension that she's got to do something for the sake of her people, she requests a fast. So going to verse 15 of the previous chapter, Esther sent this reply to Mordecai, go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days or three days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, this three-day fast, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. And so the threat of death hung very real over her. If I perish, I perish. But she didn't perish. She didn't die. Why? Well, we are sometimes really quick to go to her faith, and that's absolutely true. On our part, it's faith. But how did the king make up his mind that day to hold out the gold scepter? Again, going to Proverbs, we find out that God is in control. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. He directs it like a watercourse wherever he pleases. I love that. God is controlling the very thoughts of that king. Did you know that God can control someone's thoughts? He gives us freedom with our thoughts, right? But God can. Kings, bosses, presidents. I actually find this gives me great peace in the election season to know that God can direct like a child in a child on a beach. You know, they make a pool of water, and then they can say, I can make the water go here, and God can just do whatever he wants to do. I hope we're finding our peace in that. So we celebrate Esther's brave faith indeed, but she is the secondary hero because God is always the hero of his world and his word. So, yeah, Xerxes saw her royal robes and her beauty and her courage, but it all meant nothing if God had not directed his heart. And so Esther chose to trust God, who is never named, but who is never absent. in this event, in this story, in this book. Obeying God is often frightening because there is no guarantee that the scepter is going to be held out. There's no guarantee that if you trust God, you will always be safe. It'll always go well. You will always make a profit, and you'll be happy. And if you hear any preacher who is promising health, wealth, and happiness if you follow X, Y, and Z, then they have forgotten Hebrews 11, the hall of faith, that list of those who obeyed God, some who it turned out well, and others who were sawn in two, because God had a larger, longer plan that they couldn't see. So what do we do when we face these critical moments because we don't know how it's going to turn out? Fast and pray. If God leads you to fast. But obviously fasting including prayer. So be praying. I was thinking of the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus said, ask and you'll receive, seek and you'll find, and door will be open to you. Why? And it's because God's like a father who gives good gifts. So we know we're supposed to ask. But you know, in the same Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, and this is how you should pray. Our Father in heaven, your kingdom come, your will be done. Is that a contradiction? Because he said, ask and it'll be given to you. That's our will. But then he says, no, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. It's not a contradiction, because we will naturally ask according to our will. But the second part is the hard part, because that's where we say, I back off and I say, I submit, because while I know what I want on earth, I cannot see the plan in heaven. And so your will be done on earth like I know you are doing it. And it's no contradiction at all. So Esther and the Jews of Susa fasted and prayed and God answered, and it's a great ending, you could say, to that moment of faith, and her life is spared, but that it's not over. It's not over. So now what should she do? Well, Esther clearly was seeking God's mercy through Xerxes, but it seems that in that time of prayer, she also received God's wisdom, because we now see what her plan is. Verse 3. Then the king asked, what is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it'll be given you. If it pleases the king, replied Esther, let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I've prepared for him. Bring Haman at once, the king said, so that we may do what Esther asks. So the king and Haman went to the banquet Esther had prepared that very day. As they were drinking wine, the king again asked Esther, now what is your petition? It'll be given you. And what is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted. Esther replied, my petition and my request is this. If the king regards me with favor, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come tomorrow. Again, that is, to the banquet I will prepare for them. Then I will answer the king's question. Wow. She patiently delays her request, her true request, but invites the king and Haman to this series of two very private banquets. Actually, we'll see, it's brilliant not to just blurt out her request. I mean, he had promised her, he said it twice, to the half of my kingdom, which kind of was an ancient exaggeration. You wouldn't have done it, but it means whatever you want. Why didn't Esther go for it right away? She seems to have some concern. I mean, she's just survived. The scepter was held out. And in her plan, because she thought this through, she thought, I won't know, even if he holds out the scepter, I won't know his real attitude. And in fact, if I just blurt out my heart right away, the king is going to be kind of put on the spot. Maybe embarrassed, because he's the one who has just recently honored Haman. He's the one who just gave up his signet ring, anything you want. He's the one who essentially signed the decree to kill all the Jews. So if I just confront him, and I've not even seen him for 30 days, I don't. So she is patient. In fact, she had this plan in mind because she says it's the come today to a banquet, verse 4. I prepared for him. So she had the banquet prepared before she walked out there and didn't know if she'd live through it. Let the king come today to a banquet. She waited patiently, which is what faith has to do. I mean, how often has your request to God been like that? Unless it's like car going off the cliff, God has to answer pretty quick. Pretty much, it seems like what God is doing is teaching us patience. Learning patience with God's plan is part of the plan of God, that we would learn to wait on Him. So there's generally more deliberate types of things. But waiting on God does not always mean just being passive and doing nothing, because she had a plan going. I had to think, where did she come up with this idea? Remember, they prayed and fasted for 3 days? And she said, I'll be doing it, verse 15 of chapter 4. I'll be praying with my maids. It could have been one of the maids who said, Esther, if you survive this, let's talk. What if you did this? Because in the process of hearing from God, we do listen, hopefully, to those trusted people, godly people, hopefully, around us. So she had a plan, but she waited, and she's patient, and it's some risk in waiting. What if the king gets mad halfway through this double banquet thing? But he's not upset. He feels favored. She's doing something special for me. I think the king feels intrigued by her. What does she want? What's this wife of mine really thinking? Said so many husbands since. But what is she thinking? What does she want? It seems like, again, maybe being a king is kind of boring, so kind of playing this game with Esther appealed to him. Bring Haman at once so we can do what Esther asks. Not only does a king feel honored, but Haman feels honored. He has no clue she's Jewish. He has no clue that he is actually her arch enemy. And Esther's no dummy. Keep your friends close and your enemies closer. So it says that at verse 6, as they were drinking wine, and don't think that Esther didn't know how much wine meant to her husband. Remember that six-month party he started out with in chapter 1. So a big meal and wine, and his wife is suddenly fascinating and charming. What is your petition? What do you really want, Esther? I want another banquet. Now, this is getting really, like, interesting. Did she make another banquet because she was afraid or shrewd? She died patiently, relationally. I'm going to reconnect with my husband. Banquet 2 is in her plan. Or did she pivot? Did she get kind of spooked? How about we just do another banquet? We don't really know. We kind of are left to kind of fill in the blanks of what's going on here. But regardless, remember the sovereignty of God in the king's mind. The sovereignty of God is also working through Haman's mind, which is as evil as it gets, because God allows evil people to do evil things, which will result in their ruin and justice eventually, right? So we give Esther her due as we read her. She did the hard thing, and we're very hopeful for her. We couldn't tell if she had really a true faith in God as she started out and became queen and all the things she went through, but now we see her maturing. We see her faith growing, particularly because she's willing to do the hard thing of trusting and obeying God as God was directing her. And that's basically a life principle. If you do the easy thing now, it'll be harder later. If you do the hard thing now, it can actually be easier. If you save the money now, there's more later, whatever. So is there some way in which God has shown you something hard you must do. It's the right thing, it's the biblical thing, it's the wise thing, but it's not the way you normally do things. It's not the way most people do things. It's not even maybe the way some of your friends or peers do things, but you know the Spirit is speaking to you about this would be the right thing to do. And your mind is like, can I actually get out of this familiar rut that this is how I always do things? And because the fear creeps in if I did something different. If I apologize, and God's leading me to apologize, if I apologize, they could just turn around and use it against me. I become vulnerable, right? Or if I give up this time to help someone, then they're going to just keep on asking me. Or if I give generously, there won't be enough for me, or whatever it is. Because faith in God always has an intrinsic risk. We don't know all the outcomes. And it'll be a hard thing unless we are so saturated and know our God that He is a good God and that the plan of heaven is a long view of good. So faith in God is always intrinsically have some risk, but we're trusting the goodness of God. And faith in God is also, here's why it's hard, it's because it's humbling. Because to trust God means to relinquish control of a situation. If we can predict and control, well, I know I'm going to do this and that, and then this is going to happen because I'm trusting God, well, then you're probably not trusting God because you've got it all figured out. And so there is some relinquishing of control. So we're as we come to this part of that chapter, we're cheering for Esther, and the story is going to shift from her, but it's Haman's turn, and we actually see the role of emotions because Esther has overcome her emotion of fear to trust God. Haman is going to be overcome by his emotion of anger, and that'll lead to his ruin. Verse 9. Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. I mean, that contrast kind of tells you everything you need to know about Haman. He was controlled by his emotions. We take it that the banquets were lunch banquets. I take it that way because back in verse 4, come today to a banquet, and there's actually quite a bit of things that have to take place that evening yet, the verses 9 through 14, and then the next banquet is the next day. So he's happy. He comes home from lunch with the king and queen, and you'd think it'd be a little bit awkward just being like the third wheel at a king and queen, but nah, not Haman. He just eats it all up. He's just basking in the glory of himself. This is about me. He's on an emotional high, but how long does it last? Until he sees Mordecai at the king's gate, and he didn't rise, he didn't show fear, he didn't kneel. This guy's supposed to be afraid of me. And so he's filled with rage, wrath, fury. How many people did it take to ruin his good day? Just one. But then, how many people does it take to ruin a good day? How many criticisms do you need to hear? How many slights do you need to feel? You need like this one. You can just kind of cast a pall over our whole day, right? And that's what lit the fuse. Did Mordecai insult him? Did he call him names? Did he turn his back, snub him? Mordecai enraged him by doing absolutely nothing. Because I think Mordecai's faith is growing here too. He says, hi, Haman. Everybody else is kneeling, bowing. And Haman is enraged. He goes from glee to ferocious rage. Pride does that. In fact, what pride does is it puts us on an emotional roller coaster. He goes from euphoric to enraged. because he is driven by and controlled by his emotions. Emotions are not wrong. Notions are natural. These events of 474 BC, everybody's got emotions here. Xerxes, when he didn't have a queen, Mordecai, Esther, Haman, they all have emotions. But how we handle, react to our emotions becomes a thermometer, really, of our spiritual, emotional, mental health. And he's on a roller coaster. Ultimate pride and then deepest rage. He's a ticking time bomb. And anger is this core emotion that we have to control. So, a wise king Solomon talked a lot about anger in the book of Proverbs. A person who has a quick temper does foolish things. A person with great anger bears the penalty, but if you deliver him from it once, you'll have to do it again. There's a whole cycle. Do not make friends with an angry person. You're going to be caught up in it. An angry person stirs up dissension. You can kind of track an angry person. It's all about sides. As punching the nose produces blood, so stirring up anger produces strife. So when we don't control our anger, there's just a whole list of consequences that come up. We make foolish decisions, and so we face same consequences just over and over. You just kind of see this cycle. You don't have many friends, and you're just surrounded by conflict. It's just, we can see where this is going with Haman. So as we see some of these traits in ourselves, we should ask ourselves, why am I angry? Do we ask ourselves that if we feel angry? Do we ask, why am I angry? Why was Haman so angry? Verse 10. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, so he grits his teeth. Calling together his friends and Zeresh, his wife, Haman boasted to them about it's like a list, his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honored him and how he had elevated him above the other nobles and officials. And that's not all, Haman added. I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave. And she has invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. So, what's the cause of his anger? It's the same thing that caused him to boast. It's pride. It's arrogance. The principle here is that arrogant people blame others. If you'd have asked Haman, why are you so angry? Obviously, Mordecai didn't kneel. It's Mordecai's fault that I am so angry. And we look at this and go, come on, Haman. You're angry because you're an arrogant, angry man. It's because you're so full of yourself. But arrogant people blame others. So we have to look at ourselves when we blame others. So maybe this seems almost silly, but minor examples of stuff that kind of can tick us off or start showing anger, just kind of as a laboratory of emotions. Where are my shoes? Where is my mug? Where is, when you ask it in that tone, you're sure that somebody else, you're shifting blame, right? You didn't misplace your shoes. Somebody must have moved them because I am too good to have lost them myself. Pride. Who spilled this juice? My socks are sticky and because I wouldn't be so clumsy as to spill juice, and if I had, I'd be so good that I would have cleaned it up. So, pride. You're making us late. We yell at someone in the family. If you did it this morning, just relax. But why would that bother you? Except that somehow someone's going to think less of you, you show up less, you come across as irresponsible or embarrassed. Pride. So, We all struggle with anger. But do we realize that maybe God gives us all this little stuff to practice? To ask ourselves the question, why do I get angry? So that we can, on a smaller scale, say, you know what? I've got a pride problem. Because I'm always shifting. I've always got to find out who did this and make sure they know that I'm better than them or whatever. So we have kind of have Haman's raw extreme just to, if nothing else, alert us to our own. So arrogant people try to blame others for their anger. Secondly, arrogant people want others to join them on their emotional roller coaster. So misery loves company, but so does bragging. So he starts out bragging like crazy, and then he turns and then blames Mordecai. And he does this, who? Verse 10, his friends and Zeresh. So he said, you got to know how great I am, and you got to know how terrible this other guy is. If you feel criticized, is your first impulse, I got to go find an ally and tell them how awful this is. Because I felt put down, and so please, someone affirm how wonderful I am, and I'll just drop a little bit of this slander and gossip about this, how awful this other person is. That phenomenon we could call Hamanitis. That we want to build ourselves up and put someone down. He boasted about his wealth, all this stuff, and then he puts down Mordecai. I've got all this money. I have 10. By the way, when he said about his sons, he had 10 sons, we'll find out in chapter 9, which was regarded as being very, you know, very honorable, and as if Haman controlled the gender of his kids. And that's not all. He said, I'm the only person Queen Esther invited. What are his friends thinking about this time? I mean, really, like internally, are they like gagging in disgust? And I'm going to another one tomorrow. It must have been so fun to hang out with Haman. But here's the thing. They are probably so addicted to their own importance by being associated with somebody so important that they're not going to say a thing. If it had been social media era, they'd have been taking selfies of themselves with Haman and posting it online because I'm a friend of Haman. I got to go to that party and... But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. So he says, join me in my joys and in my terrible humiliation at this horrible man, Mordecai. Third principle, arrogant people attack those who don't honor them. They don't recognize how great I am. There's a popular psychological diagnosis for someone with these traits of Haman. Narcissism or narcissistic personality disorder. Mayo Clinic, I'm just picking up some phrases from Mayo Clinic's definition of this so-called disorder. Unreasonably high sense of their own importance, seeks too much attention, wants people to admire them, inability to care about the feelings of others, not sure of their self-worth, upset by the slightest criticism. And, you know, I'm reading that and going, Haman, 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 Haman. And all the rest of us. Hey, want to be important, admired, doubt our worth, hate to be criticized, going, it's just a matter of degree. This is humanity. Of course, Haman is humanity gone amok. It's just a matter of degree that it is all about me. And there's no cure for that but Jesus Christ. Do we see ourselves for what we are worth, or what we are worth to Christ is the bottom line. We're saved by grace, got our doctrine right, we've got eternity squared away. See, we were saved not because there was anything admirable about ourselves. We make a strong point of that, right? We're saved by grace, not faith. I'm by faith, God's grace, not works. So, do we think like that? That I am important not because of who I am or what I've done or what I can do or what people think of me. I am important because I am important to Christ. I've done nothing to impress God, and so I have nothing to prove to others. And so my only real reason for boasting is to boast, as Paul said, in the cross, to boast of Christ. And so that as I struggle with self-worth and criticism or slights or whatever, I find that my identity is simply this: I'm with him. And he doesn't judge me based on my human worth. I'm with him. And so if someone criticizes us, are we secure enough in our identity in Christ to just let it slide? Scholar Joyce Baldwin wrote, in regard to Haman actually, "Lesser men exaggerate slights. The great can afford to overlook them." In other words, Haman showed he's a lesser man. To exaggerate slights, the great can afford to overlook slights. It's a sign that our faith is growing when we care more and more and more of how God regards us and care less and less and less about what people think. Oh, Haman, you fell into a pit of your pride so that if anybody punctures your little facade of greatness, you go to pieces. So what does Haman, what do Haman's wife and friends do? Because he really needs somebody to set him straight and tell him to get over himself. "All this gives me no satisfaction. As long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate," verse 14, "his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, 'Have a gallows built 75 feet high and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go with the king to the dinner and be happy.'" This suggestion that appalls us delighted Haman. And he had the gallows built. He says, "Great idea." So they pacify him, they coddle him, they agree with him. In fact, they make it worse. His wife, Zeresh. Wow. Don't ever name your baby girl Zeresh. He married badly. She not only supported his sin, she accelerated his sin. "Have a gallows built 75 feet tall." Some Bible scholars doubt that that's really true because it seems so high. It's basically in front of this room to the back and wouldn't fit any of the building codes in Wisconsin. But I don't think that this happy couple was too concerned about public codes. They spitefully envisioned that they were going to somehow hoist Mordecai's lifeless body up above the tree so that everybody could see. This is what happens if you don't kneel in front of Haman. This is what will happen to you if you dare protest this decree that's just been passed out that we're going to kill and plunder all the Jews. And so after doing that, this little special club decides that he could go to that dinner and be really happy the next day. And because the more arrogant you are, the more joy you find in horrific things happening to your rivals or enemies. Because retaliation is a primary tool of a vengeful, arrogant person. Make him pay. The desire to retaliate, not just retaliation, is a sign of our unresolved anger. Just again, just like Spirit gives us little signals. Because sometimes our retaliation is pretty well hidden because we just think it. We just wish it. And when we're happy about that, that our rival, because it's not just about wars and feuds, it's rival Christians or somebody who's good at the same thing we're good at. Unresolved pride, anger, and revenge. We should be grateful there's a guy like Haman to make it so obvious to us that we would at least look inside ourselves with some honesty and ask ourselves, how can we be released from pride, anger, and revenge? Because it can destroy us. And then I think back to those 3 days that Esther spent fasting and praying. And that's where I think it happened. That in her mind, all of her fears, any pride she had that, you know, because I'm the queen, it all kind of like, God, it's just me and you, and this seems to be the right thing to do. I need to step out and trust and obey you. And she was able to do that only because, as we were singing that new song, I depend on you. I depend on you. This abiding in Christ, John 15, that's the only way we're going to be transformed from those habits that we have. And so she was able to make that brave step of faith. And the hardest part was what happened before that, where she let go and said, I'm trusting you. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we just take your word and we see you working invisibly in this amazing set of events in which you preserved your people. It was your hand all the time. And Lord, I just thank you that someday in eternity we can look back and see that was your hand and this was your hand, and the times that, Lord, you taught us to trust you. You taught us to wait. You taught us to be wise. You taught us to resist doing what seems right, because we see in men like Haman what happens when you follow what you feel like doing. So give us that extreme grace and wisdom to find our identity and peace in you and not in ourselves. In Jesus' name, amen.